Christianity is the Only Way was presented by Wes Hurd on September 30th, 2003 at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the first talk in part one of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Let's pray. Heavenly Father, to the degree that we understand you and understand what you've done for us, we are incredibly grateful. Our prayer is that you will help us understand more, not just of the head, but of the heart. But we do need to understand, so we ask for your help in understanding, clarifying, illuminating, and then especially in making this series and the topics that we address concerning your gospel and the issues that surround us today and the culture and the times in which we live, that this would be profitable for us, encouraging to us, and ultimately be a significant part of taking us toward maturity and understanding our faith. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, indeed, welcome to the first session. And I have when I was assigned this topic, I thought, the topic was cryptically put, why is Jesus the only way? Or Jesus is the only way? Why is Christianity making these kinds of claims? And it occurred to me that indeed, the Bible and the biblical Christianity make some audacious claims. They're audacious. Let me give you two central claims. The Bible's claim is that the view of what's real and valuable, of reality itself, that the Bible portrays, God, man, the universe, what it means to be human, their origin, our origin, and our destiny, our ultimate purpose, that the Bible's picture of those things is absolutely accurate. That's an astounding claim in the atmosphere and the intellectual and cultural atmosphere in which we live today. It claims that it is true. The spirit of the Bible's message and how it carries that composite picture to us is that we ought to believe it, not because it feels good, not because it is culturally plausible or implausible in the social circles that we run in or the culture that we live in, but that we ought to believe it because it is quite simply true. That's the reason we believe it. The second major claim, a second major claim, and these are kind of central, I think, to the whole picture that the Bible presents to us, is that Jesus Christ is God incarnate, and that he is indeed the only way, the only path to truly understanding the God who is there. Now, in today's popular and intellectual culture, this claim, these kinds of claims, these exclusivist, universal kinds of claims seem they seem silly. They're laughable in the culture in which we live, at best, or sort of innocent religious ideas and beliefs that we can embrace if they happen to make us feel good. In the best case scenario. In the worst case scenario, these kinds of claims are increasingly seen as almost a kind of totalitarianism, and particularly religious claims in the sense that, of course, everyone knows that religion is unprovable and that religion is a matter of where you grow up, and that it doesn't, that religion is a matter of one's personal preference, what makes sense to one. It doesn't have to do with reason, it doesn't have to do with facts, it doesn't have to do with any of that kind of stuff. It's only a matter of the culture in which one is embedded. So to make universalist kinds of claims is literally outrageous. It's offensive. What I would like to do tonight is spend some time on, I would like to spend a little bit of time talking about why that's the case today, giving a little, tracing a little bit of a background and context for looking at this question of how do we consider the Bible's claim that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and that He's the only way to know, understand, and understand God and fulfill human destiny. I want to look at the structure around that. And the second thing I want to do is actually address, look at a passage in the New Testament in which I think it becomes clear what the nature of the claim is. That is, it's not so much an apologetic for why, except in the sense that as I try to unpack it, my hope is that you'll feel the compelling nature of the claim that Jesus is making in the pages of the New Testament, and that it's compelling in the sense that it rises up and makes this enormous claim on our life, on how we see reality. So that's where I want to go tonight. The first part, I'd like to talk about the context for the question. We have lived through a modern time. We now live in what people call a postmodern time, a postmodern climate. The postmodern mind and psyche is now the one that dominates the atmosphere around us today, both in the popular culture and intellectual and academic culture at the university in particular. Now, the question of whether or not these claims are true, as namely whether Christ is the only way or not, that's a valid question. It's a historical question. It's a question that there's a certain very real sense in which Jesus and the apostles have faced that question in the pages of the New Testament. Jesus was questioned in the context of the Hebrew people in Jerusalem and outlying areas, and the apostles were certainly questioned about that as we read about those things in the Acts of the Apostles. So it's not a new question, and it's an appropriate question in a certain sense. It's the modern or postmodern context that frames the question that causes this strangeness to the question. The audacity of the question becomes even worse, in a sense, than it existed under the historical circumstances that question has traveled down through history. The question, in other words, has kind of become, today, it's become loaded. It's almost overloaded with a lot of context and a lot of atmosphere around it that makes the question heat up and become even more of an issue, in a sense. Now, if we start asking the question about the philosophical context, and mainly I'm talking about the modern era up through the 20th century here, the latter part of the 20th century. In recent philosophy, over the last, say, 200, 250 years or so, the question has been framed by the climate that was raised by the Enlightenment and by the modern, quote, modern era, namely the question of certainty about our knowing. How can we know that something is really true? How can we know with a measure of certainty that something is true? The questions of knowledge and certainty and truth in that sense framed the question in the modern Enlightenment era. Descartes framed the question and sort of set the ground for, if we know something, that if something is claiming to be true, we have to know it with certainty. It has to be undoubtable. It has to be provable. Either by rational argument, according to the rational school, or by empirical argument, that is by hands-on, repeatable, scientific kinds of empirical evidence. The truth can only be truth in the sense that it can be certain on those grounds and with those criteria. Descartes, Hume set up a great tradition of skepticism that we can't really know. Kant followed that up by trying to soften it a bit and say, well, we can know in certain frames. We always color our knowledge, so there's a great subjective our knowledge is always shaped by the shape of our own minds and our own understanding. We never know truth as it really is out there. It's always colored and shaped by our perceiving and reception of the truth, of what we're taking to be true or what's alleging to be true. The result of all this is that true and valid knowledge can only be that knowledge that we have some kind of certainty about. Rational certainty, empirical certainty. It has to be, in a sense, repeatable or provable knowledge. Questions of metaphysics or morals or religion are beyond the pale of this kind of truth. Religion is a different kind of truth. It exists above the world where we can really prove things and really know things in this sense. It's beyond the pale. So automatically, the modern era took issues of religion, metaphysics, the real meaning of things, the ultimate knowledge of things, what they really truly are in themselves. We can't really know that kind of stuff. It's been pushed beyond the pale of certainty, and therefore we really can't know it in the way that we can know scientific irrationally provable kinds of things. Now, that was the modern frame, and now we've moved into this, we've shifted into a postmodern frame. The postmodernist today is built on the shoulders of modernism on the one hand, but it also is critical of modernism in another sense. The postmodern environment says truth and knowledge is all constructed. That the moderns would allege that we could know anything with certainty, even scientific knowledge with certainty, is actually a myth. The postmodernist critique of reason and knowledge and even empirical knowledge is that even that stuff is a construct. Namely, all of our knowledge, or what we take to be knowledge, is created or constructed by our culture, primarily through our use of language. So what we really know, we know on the basis of the language that we use. The language we use gives us the conceptual vocabulary that we can think with, and beyond that, we can't think. So it's socially constructed. Whatever is within the frame of our culture by means of our language, those things we can know in the postmodernist sense of that language really being what we know. We know the language, but we really don't know what the language is referring to, that thing, that objective thing out there. So it takes the modern skepticism yet another step. This series of this development in the climate, the intellectual, the academic, and even the social, and even the popular climate that we live in, has created a condition that not only exists in the academic and in the philosophical world at the highest level of the knowledge industry that we're all somewhat familiar with, universities and colleges and higher learning and research and the like, but it's also sifted its way and drifted its way right down to the street level. I mean, I don't know how often your sensibilities allow you to drift by the MTV stations, but occasionally I whip by there and happen to just catch a few moments or, you know, a short period. And I'm so impressed every time I do that, that everything that's going on, even the advertising for the way they communicate, the way they advertise, the way they promote what they promote, is all so infected with this notion of truth being a construct, that ideas of morality, ethics, and truth are simply malleable, shapeable, and reshapeable notions that we carry around as personal preferences rather than being something that we actually objectively know and somebody else can objectively know it the way we know it. That's simply, it's just down on the street level. And what that's done is it's set up a condition in which believing any kinds of exclusivist or what they would call exclusivist or absolute truth claims, universal kinds of truth claims, are just, as I started out saying earlier, are just, you know, laughable, or worse, they are horrible in the sense that they are making claims that exclude. They're not inclusive, socially, politically inclusive. Our problem is that we have too many divisions already. And that kind of talk and that kind of difference, that kind of delineation that's made by these kinds of truth claims, that's the heart of the problem. And it's a problem because we can't know that kind of truth anyway. We can't know truth in that way anyway. So that's the climate in which the question that we're talking about tonight, about the exclusive claims of Christ and the question of, is he the only way? That's the kind of context that we're living in. I would even argue that, I think you would probably resonate with this at some level, that post 9/11 and the with all the issues that are related to terrorism and Islamically based, religiously based terrorism, that's simply fodder or proof for the fact that when Islamic or any kind of fundamentalist religious claims are made, that's the real problem. We need to just chill. We need to mellow out. We need to back off. Nobody should be making those kinds of claims. That's the kind of atmosphere we're living in. And because it's that kind of universal absolutist claim that can become political, that can become ideological, that can become the basis for war, for difference, for conflict. And that's what we need to get rid of. That's what we need to try to find answers to. Now, I want to step back from that kind of quick description of the intellectual climate and the cultural climate that we live in, and ask a question that the postmodernists would say is not a legitimate question, because it too is asking for what could be seen as universal truth claims. That is, this is true truth. It's true for everybody. They would say that's a religious question. Therefore, it fits over into the personal, not into the public and philosophical realm, not where we can really talk about issues of truth or those kinds of things. Namely, the question is, or the series of collection of questions are, why do humans concern themselves with these questions at all? Why does there seem to be, and why does there seem to have been in history, a universal quest in all historical periods and all cultures in all cultural settings for answers to these big questions, the big metaphysical questions, the questions that are, that seem to be, how do we define what it means to be human? What is man? What does it mean to be human? Where did man come from? Where does the human being find its origin? What is our destiny? Questions of our purpose. Questions of what is valuable. If it's valuable, it's making a claim on how we ought to live or how we ought to look at things. Why do people continue to ask those kinds of questions? And a postmodernist would say, it's just a funny fact of history. There's nothing universally significant about that question that's buried in the core of man. It's simply something that we may, in fact, eventually, that question may disappear. Who knows? In the end, the present postmodernist culture that we're in takes such questions, that is, who are we, what are we about, where are we going, what are the answers to the big questions about what's true, what's valuable, what does it mean to be a human being? It takes those questions and says, those are unanswerable. We cannot know truth that universally answers those kinds of questions. They're illegitimate questions. Those are religious questions. They pertain to whatever you construct in your own world, in your own group, in your own culture. Or they say, not only do we, on the one hand, you can't have answers, but they say, well, if you need answers for that, if you really want answers for that, and you seem to be compelled to need answers for those questions, then just pick them. You know, there's a variety, there's a potpourri, there's a virtual smorgasbord of ideas and beliefs and religions and philosophies out there. Just pick one. None of them are any better than any other. And to say anything other than that is to be cast in the frame of a Nazi. To make such absolutist claims, to make those kinds of claims is ugly. Some of you who have attended classes in the secular culture know what I'm talking about. People confronting these questions today who run into the biblical claims of Christ's uniqueness and the universal claims are, as I've just said, annoyed or deeply disturbed by these things. And in some cases, absolutely outraged by these claims. Non-Christians respond with almost a kind of incredulity that how could you even entertain those kinds of questions? Or at least entertain those questions to be answered in some sort of certain truthful, ultimately truthful sense. I would argue that Christians, many of us in this room, have felt the pressure and the stress that is created in this atmosphere. People who have been raised in Christian families, people who have been raised in the church, people who have been raised in an understanding of the world and being human in a Christian culture, are also vulnerable and feeling the weight of these things. I listened to a tape just the last couple of weeks, a really good lecture given by a fellow at Labrie Ministry in England, and he suggested that there are four things that he can identify, at least these four, that have had an impact not only on the non-Christian world, but also on the Christians that come to Labrie and with whom he has to interact day in and day out, week after week, in trying to solve these kinds of stresses that they feel. First issue is epistemology, that is the question of knowledge. which you just talked about, we live in an atmosphere where we simply, it's taken for granted in our day, in our culture, and in the climate we live, that knowledge cannot be certain. We cannot know the truth, with a capital T. The result is that pragmatically, we tend to turn toward the personal, to relationships, to things that seem very almost emotionally and sensually in a tactile way seem real to us. They seem more real to us. Ideas and philosophy and that kind of stuff can't answer our questions. What really makes sense to a lot of people today is that, you know, a person standing right next to me with whom I can interact, with whom I can care about, I can have emotions with, that kind of thing, that's more real. That's more certain to me than ideas. So the whole area of epistemology, of knowing truth, is a major issue. The second thing he suggested is what he calls the romantic spirit. The period of romanticism that existed in Western civilization ran from about 1790 to about 1850. Across Europe, it was a pan-European intellectual and artful movement in the arts and humanities. And essentially, the spirit of the Romantic period was that it was a contradiction to and a counter to the Enlightenment that was also the spirit and ideas of the Enlightenment that were emerging at the same time, saying reason is the answer. Reason and the mind and rationality is where we get our truth. And the Romantic spirit was a reaction to that and said, no, we don't get all our truth from that. We can't get all our truth from that. It's wrong to neglect our feelings and our deep intuitions and emotions, our creativity, our self-expression. We need to be people who can humanly express ourselves, and that's more meaningful than just a propositional idea or propositional truth. The key to being human is more about imagination and feeling than it is about ideas that we believe with our heads and our minds. The third one is integrity. There is a spirit out there today that, in a sense, is, and it's a good one in a sense, it's not negative necessarily. The spirit of integrity is that it's more important to be sincere and authentic to yourself than to correct your beliefs. Given the postmodern climate, you can't be correct in your beliefs anyway, in an ultimate sense. So it's better to hang on to what you can hang on to, namely, be true to yourself. Be true to what seems or feels right to you, and just go with that. You know, there's a certain sense in which that can be turned into, can be turned negatively, because it's given up on the idea of being able to know something reasonably. There's another sense in which it's true, in the sense that even those raised in Christian families, raised in Christian culture, have been taught on the basis of the Bible to be people and persons of integrity. That if something appears to be true, that you should embrace it. You are morally and ethically compelled to embrace what appears to be true to you. What happens many times is that a young person graduates from high school in a circumstance and in a frame in which they've had a certain amount of academic studies and friends and sports and girlfriends and boyfriends and parties, and you know, it's been a pretty circumscribed world, and suddenly they step out into the university, or they step out into the world and they start imbibing the world, and suddenly the world has changed. What's happened is that their Christianity has explained this much of their world. It's explained that small world that they've been in. But suddenly, as they step into something like the university environment or the real world environment and start to look at the power and the influence and the attractiveness and the seductiveness of the world out there and all these ideas that are floating around out there, suddenly, if they haven't been given equipment or tools or the impetus or the encouragement to see Christianity as truth as a set of lenses by which they can look at all of reality, then their Christianity is only capable of explaining that personal, small world. And suddenly there's a tension between what their Christianity and their faith can explain and this huge world that it cannot explain. It has no answer. It has no response. It is... It just seems to them incapable of really addressing all these important political, philosophical, ideological, philosophy of religion, personal moral kinds of... I mean, the personal area, that they've got that. But all these other issues become huge and challenging. And the faith hasn't been put to them in such a way that they can actually entertain wrestling with those ideas in terms of Christianity being true truth. It's just their personal faith or personal religion. So that integrity that they've been taught is actually compelling them in a certain sense to open themselves up to the validity and possibility of a lot of ideas that they've never been exposed to before. The fourth thing is authority. He suggests that in some respects, this relates to the illustration I just gave, I think, that when we present religious ideas or faith as an orthodoxy, as an authoritative set of doctrines, and only as such, many young people today feel that we're asking them to believe something we're asking them to believe something and to be certain about something that they are not that certain about. Especially given this framework where truth and the whole idea of truth and knowledge is so uncertain. So if these doctrines and orthodoxy and ideas seem to be are handed to them as certainties, and they don't feel the compelling nature of those certainties at some level, then that you're asking them to be confident from an authoritative source that they don't necessarily have that confidence. So all of these four things he identifies from his observation of working with students at Labrie seems to kind of build an atmosphere in which there are many troubled Christians troubled in their belief on the basis of the atmosphere that they've been raised in. So here's the situation. As has been in history, the legitimate questions regarding the claims of biblical Christianity continue today. We're addressing it tonight. But the intellectual and psychological and social frame around the questions has shifted rather drastically. So we're not really asking, if we're asking philosophically under the modern frame, we could ask the question, is truth possible? That's one question. If we say, well, yes, truth is possible, we can know the truth, then the question becomes perhaps historical and evidential. Can I look at these claims about Jesus being the only way from an historical evidential standpoint? And then from a social and psychological perspective, we can look at these questions and not so much even consider them intellectually, but we actually feel the implausibility of them in the social circles that we're in the social culture, in that strange, mysterious way in which culture and society affects us at a level that we're not even sure how it's affecting us. And then one more, we also can ask the question in terms of the personal and the subjective. And I want to turn to that now. And perhaps that's the most vital one. We ask all these other, give these other frames to the question, but we also ultimately come down to, if we end up at the level of saying, you know, I look at it philosophically and I think the truth is knowable, I look at it historically and evidentially and I think that there's good sound reason for believing that Jesus was who he claims and that he did what he did, that he actually came out of the grave in resurrection. And then I resist the plausibility structure around me that compels me to consider truth as malleable and uncertain, and I shouldn't consider any universalist claims, and I resist that, and I say, I'm holding that off. There's still one more level, and that's the level of, if I look at this and it seems believable to me and it seems reasonable to me, am I willing to let it penetrate my life? Am I willing to live my life based on what I think I'm coming to understand here? So let's look now, let's shift and look at the question of directly, look at the question of what is the claim? What is the nature of the claim that Jesus is making? And I'm referring almost immediately to this verse that's quoted often in John 14. I'm going to read the context of the Gospel of John, chapter 14, down a ways. The scenario is that Jesus has gathered his disciples in Jerusalem just before he is to be arrested and taken ultimately to his death. And he's meeting with his disciples who had been with him for some 3+ years. And he's teaching them one last time before this event happens. And he says in verse 1, "Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way where I am going." And Thomas says to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going. How do we know the way?" And here's that classic verse that's often put on bumper stickers. Jesus said to him, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." And then he goes on to elaborate. Now let's talk a little bit about this context here. Jesus has been with these disciples for 3 years. This clan that he's worked with has, they believe. They believe he is the Messiah. They believe at a certain level of understanding, they have embraced what Jesus is teaching. This has cost them something to come this far with Jesus. They know about the threats. They know the stress that Jesus is under. They share that stress. They know the critical persecution that is rising up and the power of the Jewish religious forces and the Roman civil authorities that could easily snatch not just Jesus' life but all their lives. They have this understanding, and now they're in this room. Jesus is teaching them some things and giving them an understanding of the fact that he's not going to be with them. He's not going to be with them this way much longer. And he's saying things, he says, "Let not your heart be troubled." And he's trying to give them some encouraging information and trying to give them, to build them up, because he knows what's coming. What's coming is, even though they've been with him, even though they believe him, even though they have embraced what he has taught them, and it has cost them something, they are disciples. They are his disciples, and he is their master. He is their Lord. He is their teacher. He knows that what they're going to go through in the next 2 days will absolutely shatter the visions that they have of him and of the vision of the of truth that he has presented to them. And so the nature of what he's giving them is Jesus, in a sense, it's his best information, it's his best shot to give them before he departs them. That's the context in which he makes this statement. "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." I think the spirit of what he's saying here is to Thomas, as Thomas has raised this question, look, in a sense, no matter what happens, remember this. Think about who I am. I am the center of your universe. I am the center of the universe for mankind. I am the way, the truth, and the life. He's making a claim, the nature of which we haven't really unpacked here, that is huge. And the intention behind it is to give them such a picture of who he is that they can hang on for what is about to happen and what they're going to go through. Now, what he means by this can be unpacked a little bit better and a little bit further if we turn to, I think, the first chapter of John. And that's what I'd like to do, is spend a few minutes talking about information that John the Apostle writes in his Gospel, in the what's called the prologue to the Gospel. There are several pieces of information that if we unpack those just for a few minutes, we can't spend a great deal of time on it tonight, but I want to at least mention these things because I think they illumine, they give light to, they help us understand the full weight of what Jesus is saying when he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. What do we find here? John, in writing his gospel, writes probably well after all the other gospel narratives have been written. He's considered his audience, he's considered what the need is, and he's writing a gospel that he thinks is required and necessary and needed. This particular gospel, the way he's going to write this is going to be significantly different than the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, for a reason. And the prologue to his gospel is almost poetic. It's a cryptic, almost poetic introduction to the entire gospel that on the one hand encapsulates the whole gospel. That is, it frames the gospel, sets up the gospel, and in a sense outlines the message of the whole gospel in just these few verses. So it's a very interesting, powerful introduction to the entire narrative that he's going to write, the entire account. Let's look at these verses. In John chapter 1, I'll just read down through it, and then I'll come back and highlight a couple of things. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In him was the life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. And there came a man sent from God whose name was John. And he came for a witness, that he might bear witness of the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he came that he might bear witness of the light. There was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came unto his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become the children of God, even to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and when we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, there's no way that I can unpack this whole section. I'm still studying it. There's still elements that I don't think I have a good grip on. But I would like to highlight some things that I think are important clues that inform this great claim that Jesus is making. What is the nature of the claim that the Bible is making about Jesus? As Jesus is quoted in the New Testament narratives, in the Gospels, and then quoted in the epistles, what is the nature of the claim as to his identity and what he was about and what his message was? And I think we find here some really cryptic, but very profound and very pregnant terms that help us understand that, the nature and the huge implications of these claims. He starts off with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word is, from the Greek, halagos, the logos. And I think that John is choosing a word here that is extremely important conceptually, and it would have been understood by his audience, and they would have understood that this term was very, very loaded. It was loaded with a notion that was taken from a very common understanding in Hellenistic Greek culture, that was, namely, that the origin of reality is the logos. That is, the logos is the mind, the transcendent reality, the creative, purposive, creating reality of the universe is captured in this sense of the logos. It is characterized as being mind in the sense that it is rational and purposive. And it is characterized as being the source of creation. What exists, exists on the basis of the logos as having ushered it into existence. And what exists is characterized by the logos. That is, it carries the character and nature of the logos. What is created is coherent with the logos, with this controlling, purposive thought or mind behind the creation. So John is taking that term, placing it at the very beginning. He's referencing, in the beginning was the logos. So he's referencing for his Jewish and Hebrew listeners and audience, he's referencing the beginning, the creation, and he's connecting the Greek term to that notion of the creation. The logos is the creator. The logos is identified as and with the creator. And then he repeats that. He says, this logos, this same one, was in the beginning with God. So John is identifying the logos with the creator God of the Hebrew revelation. So the logos is the source of the beginning of history. It forms the founding creative reality and principle of the cosmos and what exists. It forms the creation principle upon which everything in existence depends on it for its existence. And it is rational, and it is knowable. All those things packed into this notion of the logos. Then in verse 4, he takes this logos, and he identifies it with another word. He says, in the logos was life. And life, I would argue, in John's understanding and biblical understanding of things, is the metaphor for the greatest fulfillment of man. Picturing what kind of existence would be true for a human being to be absolutely, utterly fulfilled in all of their creative, all of their created potential. The description of possessing life is a description of that fulfillment. To be fulfilled is to be the possessor of life. So he's saying, in the logos was this kind of human fulfillment. The Greeks had an understanding that was common in Greek thought called eudaimonia, or the good. They had a concept, an understanding that the human being, that man, was capable of being utterly fulfilled, of fulfilling him or herself, the human being, in the sense of being the good. What What is valuable? What is that which is going to utterly fulfill man? The good, eudaimonia. And there were apparently different ideas about what that good would be. John is taking that notion and identifying that fulfillment with the notion, the biblical notion of life. That human being, those human beings who possess and can be characterized as possessors of life, are those who are utterly fulfilled in every shred of their being. Utterly, completely fulfilled in their creatureliness. Utterly satisfied in what they are. And he's identifying the Logos with that notion of the life, that in the Logos was that life. Then there's a further development. In this one, the Logos, was the life, and the life was the light of men. I think what's going on here is that this notion of being utterly, completely captured by fulfillment, utter fulfillment, utter satisfaction from the very core of our existence and being, is identified as being a kind of light. That is, when someone possesses life, that very kind of existence illumines the understanding of man such that he understands what he was created for. So in that sense, the light is a metaphor for the understanding that accompanies possessing life. That is, an utterly, completely filled understanding of, oh, this is what I exist for. This is what I'm all about. This is why I am alive. This was my destiny. This is why I was created. This. And that understanding he's referring to as light, enlightenment, in that sense. And then he says, and then there was the true light which coming into the world. Now he refers in verses 6, 7, and 8 to the John the Baptist, and he's saying John the Baptist is this precursor, but John the Baptist wasn't the light. He wasn't the true light. He says the true light was not John the Baptist. The true light was this Logos, the Logos. There was a true light which coming into the world enlightens every man. The true understanding that comes as a result of having life is a true understanding of being and existence. Here's the connection, I think, between Jesus, ultimately what we find here in this passage is, the connection between Jesus, what he taught, his perspectives, and the truth. Here's the heart of the claim. Jesus is the exegesis of the invisible God to us. When we understand and embrace this understanding of who Jesus was and his identity, and when we embrace it as the core truth of our life and the hope and our destiny, we are in possession not only of the most important piece of truth we could ever have, but we see the connection of having and pursuing what is true with Jesus. You'll notice in verse 14, which I haven't reread here in this context, that the unfolding of this prologue culminates in verse 14, where it says, this Logos, who was the life, who was the creative, purposive mind behind all creation, who was the life, who was the light, who is also the true fulfillment, the basis of the true fulfillment for the human being. This Logos became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the unique Son of God, the unique Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. So here's this connection between the Logos, creation, and the most crucial truth about nature, about the nature, identity, and meaning of man. And that is the man, Jesus. This Logos, in verse 14, the life and the light became flesh and lived with us, and Jesus was the embodiment of that Logos, which gives life, utter fulfillment, enlightens every man who embraces it and who believes it, and gives true fulfillment. Now we go back to that verse in 14 where he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me. And we understand the full weight of what he's trying to encourage the disciples with. He's trying to get them to understand the nature of who it is who is standing before them. Who it is who's in the room that is talking to them. God enfleshed. Jesus, the man, his identity. When he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, I think what he's getting at is that he is the path to the truth. That is, he is the way, and that what he teaches is the truth. His perspectives on God, on the world, on man, on the destiny of man, on the hope of man, and ultimately on the basis of what man will be judged by, he possesses, he owns, he is the expression of that. And he is the life in the sense that who he is, what he teaches, and what he accomplishes all make it possible for us to have life, to be the possessors of life. Now there's that second part of that verse, which is the one that I argue today is the most irritating claim of Jesus. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father but by me. I hope that you can conclude with me, having made my totally inadequate argument here, that it's an understandable conclusion. If he is the way to the truth, if what he teaches is the truth, if he is the embodiment of the Logos that John is referring to as the creator, the creating mind and purposive creator of all that exists, if he's identified with that, and what he teaches is the truth about that, then it follows that he would be the only way to the truth. He would be the only way to God, to understanding the Creator, to understanding reality, especially the reality of our nature and our destiny and what our real true situation is. In the end, why do we believe this? I think we believe it because we're compelled to believe it. We find ourselves being drawn and compelled to believing this claim because we gain an understanding and then an increasing understanding of the nature of the claim, and either we don't believe it or we do believe it. There are lots of tons and tons of books out there that are about the defense for the argument of the identity of Jesus, who he is, what he did, the resurrection, the historical authenticity of the Bible itself, and ultimately then the story that we have presented in the Bible and in the texts of the New Testament regarding Jesus. But ultimately, I think we assess, we think about what's wrong with the world. And we think about what ultimately what's wrong with us. And we read various plausible answers and responses to those questions. And we come to this one among many out there today. And if we find ourselves embracing it, it's because it's so compelling. The promise is so huge, and the explanation of the true problem that we have, namely that we are alienated and corrupt and in our hearts ultimately evil creatures who need to be transformed, which is a part of the gospel message that Jesus brought, if we find that compelling, then we embrace it. And we believe that exclusive, universal, absolute kind of claim. I'm going to close here, and then we can entertain some questions and responses to this. And I'm also going to invite anybody here who's... it's just a discussion, so if you have something you'd like to say along with a question that maybe fills in something I left out, I would welcome that. But let me close with this very fascinating quote by Simone Weil. Simone Weil was a young French Jewish woman who embraced elements of Christianity through Catholicism. But it was in World War II, she found herself being able to escape the Nazi occupation of Paris, found herself in England. Actually, I think she came to the States, and then she was back in England. And she was so profoundly crushed by what her fellow Parisians and Frenchmen were going through, that she had escaped, that she actually wouldn't eat. And she was so darkened by what was happening to them. But she's and ultimately she died in that situation, partly exacerbated by the fact that she was actually starving herself. But the interesting thing about it is she was an extremely inquisitive, kind of don't fit the categories, French woman, Jewish writer who had embraced elements of Catholicism. In particular, she had really embraced Christ. She hadn't embraced the whole church. She hadn't embraced the notion of the Pope and lots of teachings in the church. And in fact, she wouldn't submit to baptism, because she didn't feel like she could buy everything that was being put to her in terms of the orthodoxy of Catholicism. But she was a true believer. And she made this statement about the relationship between truth and Christ. I think it's a really interesting statement. "For it seems to me certain that one can never wrestle enough with God if one does so out of pure regard for the truth. Christ likes us to prefer the truth to him, because before being Christ, he is truth. Even if one turns aside from him to go toward the truth, one will not go far before falling into his arms." That's the nature of the claim that biblical faith, that biblical Christianity, that the biblical worldview is making. That it is the truth. It is the profound, dead-on, accurate explanation of God and man and how God has created and is interacting with us and what our deepest needs are. Okay, so responses, questions?
I was thinking about how so many of the world's religions nowadays, and even those people who wouldn't necessarily claim to be a part of a religion, could take that verse, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," and it was making me think that if those people were to basically throw out anything but the Gospels in the Bible, considering, if they say, well, we're going to talk about Jesus and his life and what he did and what he said, and not consider anything else because they're just interpreting what he said. I'd just kind of like to see what you would say about it, kind of elaborate a little bit more on that, saying, yeah, Jesus led a good life and he said do this and do this. What kind of evidence can we find in the Gospels that we could use as an argument towards that he really is the way, and you need to believe in him and who he is in order to get to the Father, and that it's not just do the things that he said. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Jesus is recognized by the world and by history as perhaps the greatest man that ever lived. Not necessarily embracing his identity as God, or embracing everything he taught about how mankind can be saved from its condition or our condition. So, and what he said in the pages of the New Testament, the gospel narratives, is so astounding, as even as literature, and as profound. When you look at the way he responded to the people around him, and they're just, it's like it says in the pages of John, you know, and they came back, the Pharisees, the religious leaders, sent some people out to capture Jesus and to bring him back. When they came back, they didn't have him. And they said, why don't you have him? And they said, never a man spoke like this. They were astounded. They were blown away by what he was teaching and what he was saying. So you can look at him through those eyes. And oftentimes, that interpretive approach to who Jesus is and his significance lifts those things out of the larger context and all the things that he said. And when they lift them out, they are really doing violence to the full picture that Jesus presented of himself and what he taught. So the argument, it seems to me, that at least one argument would be, you can't do that. If you really want to understand who Jesus is, you can't just pick and choose your way through the narratives. You have to look at everything he said. I think that's the nature of what one of the really powerful arguments that C.S. Lewis makes, and that a couple of very famous quotes he makes about Jesus, a man who said the things that Jesus said wouldn't just be a great man and a good guy and a model for human beings. He would either be who he claims to be, or he'd be a megalomaniac on the order of someone who said he was a poached egg. I mean, it's either what he says is true in total, or he's very deluded individual, in spite of the fact that we can draw some good morals and ideals from him.
Just getting down to the interpretation of that one bumper sticker phrase, how much hinges on the, well, in the Greek or in the Hebrew when this was written, is that he is a truth, a way, a life, or is it the way, the truth?
Jack, why don't we hand the mic back there? Jack's done more work in this area than I have. Did you hear the question?
Me?
Jack, did you hear the question?
Yes, I think so. Are you asking about the Greek syntax in particular, though? I don't remember. I don't have that in front of me. But I think, even if the first phrase is ambiguous, it's explained by the second phrase. No man comes to the Father but by me. So by the time you get to the end of his claim, I think it's obvious that what he's saying is, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And related to Stephanie's question, it seems to me that ultimately what he's really trying to focus on in saying that he's the way is that he's the litmus test, he's the touchstone, he's the gate. If you're going to get to the Father, you're going to have to deal with him. You're going to have to come through him. So he's what Paul calls the stumbling stone. You know, Jesus came along and he made a claim. He made a claim to be the light of the world. He made a claim to be the unique Son of God. He made a claim to be the visible image of the invisible God. I mean, he was making all those claims, and then he died on a cross. And we're confronted with the question then, what am I going to do with this guy who ended up dying a humiliating death as a criminal, seemingly impotent in the face of the Roman army, and then claiming to be the very representation of God himself, who is the center of the universe? And we either stumble over that claim to our own destruction, or we recognize that that's dead on right, that's the truth, like Wes has been talking about it, and embrace it. And it seems to me that the Bible's very clear. I mean, Jesus says at one point, he who believes on me will have eternal life. That when we face that claim, if we embrace the claim as true, our destiny is life. If we reject the claim as true, our destiny is eternal destruction. So he becomes the watershed. He becomes the litmus test. He becomes the one that we either stumble over to destruction or that we believe to our salvation. I think that's what he means by I'm the way. I mean, you're, one way or the other, you're going to deal with me. You've got to come through me.
Wes, do you know how certain postmodern writers sort of dodge the critique of begging their own question in terms of, for instance, if they want to describe all religions as sort of a cultural construct based upon language, et cetera, et cetera, is then not that description, which still uses the same language, a construct as well? Or if, say, they offer that they're simply trying to tell a historical narrative, any sort of narrative is a universal and sort of metaphysical as well. So is it, and that seems to be the criticism that of some philosophers who are on the other side and say that postmodernism's bunk.
Yeah.
But how do they respond to that?
I'm not sure. I think that is really a conundrum that they have to come to terms with. And the only thing that I've heard that is sort of a response would be that in the postmodernist frame, every proposal for a way of looking at things, every frame that is proposed as a way to look at things, is legitimate in the sense that it's simply a construct of language coming out of culture. And the question of whether is any one of them at any given time making some sort of universalist claim or not, they sort of brush aside in favor of the notion that what we ultimately need to do is just keep producing and offering frame after frame after frame after frame after frame, because if we ever get to the point where we offer one that we think is exclusive or universal or absolutist in no sense, in other words, universally applicable to everybody, that becomes totalitarian, that becomes political, that becomes the source and the grounding for conflict, war, destruction, hate, all those kinds of things, which we're really trying to get rid of. And the answer to that, the postmodernist answer, the only one that I've heard is the solution is to just keep offering frame after frame after frame, and don't worry about whether any one of them is actually having a larger claim on the truth or not. That's a little bit inadequate, but that's the only one I can think of off the top.
So if a frame, as they might call it, such as Nazism was offered, then they really have no critique of it.
Ultimately, I don't think so.
I mean, they could say, well, you know, violence is bad, but then again, that's just starting all over with begging the question.
Yeah, there are several, I mean, a couple of the principles, Derrida in particular, really backed away from that. But I haven't read him enough to know exactly how he constructs an ethic that would make those kinds of value claims or that sort of thing. But I know that he does. Jack, do you know? I mean, he does that. Yeah. You know, I think our time is at end here, but let me just make a comment here as we close. This is the beginning of a series that we're doing this term and next, and we're inviting you to join us and listen to and dialogue with us about what this faith, what the fundamentals and the principles and even questions about the practices of these beliefs. If we believe this, what ought it to look like in our life? Is it that if we're saying that it's, as we do often around here, that it's not a religious frame, that it's grounded more profoundly on what is really true, then what does that look like? Where does the Bible fit in? Where does the notion of praying fit in? Where does the notion of the church fit in? Where does the notion of worshiping God fit into all this? What does the Christian life look like then? Those are some of the issues that we're going to be taking on in this series. So we welcome you to invite you to come back and join us. Thank you.